Hello, this is episode number 44 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Friday, June 19, 2009. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're pleased to be joined by Internet security expert Chris Agoyan, who is a student fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's also a PhD candidate at Indiana University's School of Informatics. Chris is an up-and-coming star in the field of cyber law and technology policy, as he has quickly made a name for himself in debates over privacy policy, data security, and government surveillance. Chris straddles that line between academic and activist, and the role he often plays in many of these debates is somewhat akin to what Ralph Nader has done in many other fields through the years. Except in this case, instead of unsafe at any speed, it's more like unsafe at any setting, since Chris is often raising a stink about what he regards as unjust or unreasonable privacy or security settings that various online websites or service providers use. In our discussion today, my colleague Baron Soka and I will be talking to Chris about two of his recent crusades to get certain online providers to change their default settings to improve user security or privacy. Chris Agoyan, welcome to our show.
Hi, guys.
And Baron, thanks for joining me today to help grill Chris on these issues.
Howdy.
Okay, Chris, because you've made some news this week, let's begin with your latest crusade to get major email providers, and Google in particular, to change their default security settings on their email offerings. So explain to our listeners in clear terms what you were up to this week.
Right. So on Tuesday of this week, a letter was released to the media signed by 38 prominent security and privacy experts, essentially chastising Google for not protecting the privacy and security of its users. So the way it works essentially is that when a normal user connects to their email or edits a document in the cloud using Google Documents or Google Spreadsheets from a cyber cafe, from a public library, or a school using a wireless network, the vast majority of their information is sent what we call in the clear. That means that it doesn't have any protection at all. And what this means is that anyone with the appropriate software, which can be downloaded very, very easily, can actually listen in on that session. They can listen in on the communications, view the data that's being sent, and in many cases even hijack the connection and later log into the user's account and get all the rest of their documents and files. So, you know, this is a problem that's widespread throughout the industry. Google is not alone in rather shamelessly putting its users at risk. And Google is actually sort of better than the rest because it does offer a protecting using the same SSL, that's the secure socket technology that all the banks use and the health companies use to protect users' data as it crosses the internet. So the focus of this letter was primarily on one key issue, which is that Google has offered a setting for users to protect themselves, but has never really publicized it and has made it extremely difficult to turn on. The description for the setting is vague and not intuitive to the average user. It's hidden in a screen. It's the 13th options. And so the letter takes Google to task and says, look, you need to protect your users by default. So Google has long argued that this is a matter of choice and that users should free to choose to protect themselves and if they wish to do so. And so in this letter, we essentially say that, you know, it's fine that Google wants to make this position that choice is gain, but that the default option should be safety, and that users who are really concerned about whatever minimal speed impact this might have on their emails, they should be able to all about security in the same way that, you know, the airbag in your car is on default, and if you have a child report, you know, that can be pulled.
So Chris,
So I was just going to say that, you know, this letter went out, and about 2 hours after it was released, Google posted a blog entry onto their website saying, "We've heard the experts. We're going to be beginning a trial of using this by default for some users to see what the speed impact is." And then they took the opportunity to throw a bit of sand in their not for offering this either.
So, Chris, let me ask quick two follow-ups before I bring Baron into this to throw out some questions. First, why did the letter only go to Google and not to other email providers such as Microsoft, Yahoo, and others? And then secondly, you seem to be asking, strongly encouraging these changes be made voluntarily, but are you prepared to take this to another level to make complaints to regulatory agencies or endorse legislation as an option?
All right, so let me tackle the first question. And I think, you know, it will... And then there's direction. So the first part is that Google offers the letter also suggested that if Google wasn't willing to make encryption the default, that it should at least make the setting more prominent, maybe provide some language on the login page, you know, maybe raise the profile of that setting and maybe rephrase it so that it is actually easier for users to realize the importance of the setting. And all of those things are modifications that are very, very simple. And so I felt like it, you know, my chance of having Google flip on this issue was higher than the chance of getting Yahoo, Microsoft, or Facebook to deploy a brand new feature. You know, I was also mindful of the fact that if and when Google did buckle to the pressure, that that would then snowball and lead to considerable pressure for the other internet companies, right? So, for example, in the market for search engine privacy, we've seen that, you know, first Google came out and said that they were going to anonymize data after a period of length, and then Microsoft came out and said they were going to do it in a better way, and then Yahoo said they were going to do it not in a better way, but they were going to delete the data even faster. And so, you know, we've seen that once one company moves in the direction the others sort of feel compelled to follow. So that's the first reason that I targeted Google.
Mm-hmm.
The second is based on a lesson that I learned from the Robert Bork hearings, you know, 10 years ago. So in that incident, Robert Bork's video rental records were released to a DC newspaper, and Congress flipped out and immediately passed comprehensive privacy legislation for video rental records, based on the fear that their own video records would be released to the press. And, you know, one of the things I've noted in my interactions with policymakers over the last few years is that Gmail is heavily used in D.C. You know, Ellen used Yahoo Mail, but I think she's an outlier. For the most part, Gmail is the dominant free email service for policymakers and people of influence. And so I felt that by highlighting the insecurity of Gmail, that the policymakers, if they were to ever apply pressure, would perhaps show a little bit of self-interest in the fact that their own privacy risk. And I thought that they might not care as much about people using AOL or Yahoo Mail.
Right, got it.
And the second question was, you know, would I be willing to go down the path of promoting regulatory action or legislation? So, you know, I have a paper in draft form right now addressing some of these questions, and, you know, I'm hesitant to go down the path of advocating any kind of particular technology mandates, just because of the speed at which Congress operates. You know, I don't want them I don't want the word SSL 3.0 to be in a bill. That seems like a really bad idea. However, I'm actually fairly okay with the idea of maybe some labeling laws. So I think one of the biggest problems in this market right now is that most consumers don't realize that they have no privacy online. Google scanning their emails and the other advertisers are, but I highly doubt that they realize that when they sit down in a Starbucks, the person next to them can read their email. And that's something that's been echoed by researchers who published a paper at the CHI conference this May. So they showed that users actually take proactive steps, the steps that they know about to sort of protect their privacy, but most users have no idea about sort of the fact that the data is sent in plain text over wireless networks.
Right.
I feel like that issue of user awareness of the risks is something that could perhaps be tackled through some kind of compulsory disclosure requirement.
All right. Okay, Baron, let's bring you into this conversation because you responded to Chris's letter and from the letter from the security experts to Google with a blog post on the tech liberation front. Tell us a little bit about your pushback to Chris's letter.
Well, I first want to start by agreeing with Chris on at least 2 points. One, I like SSL. I had opted into using SSL for Gmail long before I read Chris's paper. So the debate here is not whether this is a good thing, because I think most people probably would agree that they'd like to have SSL. It's a useful feature. Second point on which I would applaud Chris is that I think that there is great value to shame artists like Chris, and I use that term in the best sense, in the marketplace. I mean, if we are going to rely on reputational incentives to provide a more effective and more market-oriented alternative regulation, it's useful to have people like Chris going out and pointing out that companies are not doing as good a job as they could be doing within a particular area. Now, having said all of that, I think that there's an important part of the story that's not really being discussed here, which is cost. And at the end of the day, there is a reason why companies don't just provide something like SSL automatically. And even though Google, in their response, said that for them cost wasn't an issue, I think what they really meant was that they had already decided to eventually implement full SSL by default for everybody. And they were simply deciding how to do that, how to roll it out, and how to implement it in a way that doesn't cause people problems. What they didn't mean, I think, is that is in a literal sense that cost isn't an issue, because it is. I don't really know exactly how much more expensive it is. Chris, I know this is a total guess on your part, but you know, as a shot in the dark, in the paper that you alluded to earlier, you suggest that it might require something like 6 times the processing power to deal with fully encrypted SSL all the time. But whatever the actual ratio is, at the end of the day, those computing cycles are expensive. Google spent something like, I had the number, but somewhere in the order of $1-2 billion on simple processing costs for data for all of its services in recent years. And so these numbers really do add up. And so for a company like Google to suddenly turn this on by default is ultimately an issue of cost. For a company like Yahoo, which is actually a far bigger player in the webmail space, they have a market share of about 56% as compared to Google's about 11%. For Yahoo to turn this on for their user base would be even more an issue of cost. And at the end of the day, something has to pay for that, and there has to be some sort of trade-off. And that might mean that users are going to have to pay for SSL, or it might mean that they're simply going to get less free storage space. But at the end of the day, we're talking about what are to users free services that are in turn supported by advertising. So I have no problem with suggesting that SSL is a useful feature and we should all have it, but there is no free lunch, and we have to figure out who's going to pay for that. And my own guess is that either people are going to voluntarily pay a little bit extra for SSL, or they're going to get less features, or there's going to have to be a better form of advertising, like more targeting, which in turn raises some privacy concerns. But something has to pay for the service.
Chris, you want to respond?
Sure. So, you know, basically everything that Baron said, I agree with. You know, SSL and encryption does require more computing resources. And, you know, I was actually rather surprised that Google just straight off the bat said that cost wasn't an issue. I don't know whether that's true or not for them. I suspect that it's more the fact that they just didn't want to get to this position where they were admitting that they put their customers at risk of identity theft in order to save a few dollars. I think it was a strategic position on their part to just say they were focusing solely on the latency and speed. You know, I think you'll take note of the fact that in our letter, we never actually ask Google to provide SSL for free. We just tell them to provide it by default. You know, you can interpret how you will. Even if the company doesn't turn encryption on by default, the proposals in the letter, I think, hold weight, you know, no matter what, right? So Google can use disclosures, right? They can say, you know, dear customer, you're checking your email from a cyber cafe right now. You know, your account can be broken into very easily. You know, click here to pay a dollar for our premium server that will protect you. You know, there's no reason why Google can't use this as some kind of upsell opportunity. And, you know, I think there's an appropriate place in the market for that. My primary beef here is with the fact that Google and others are taking advantage of the ignorance of most consumers. Most consumers think that these companies are selling them a product safe by default, right? No consumer is thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to, you know, use the service and then have my account broken into. And so, you know, I think if consumers realize how dangerous these tools and services actually were, that they might have strong reservations. And so, okay,
well,
you know.
Chris, let me push back a little bit because let me take a different perspective here than just the cost issue, which is for a lot of consumers. I mean, you're assuming a level of concern about their email and whether it's encrypted that perhaps isn't there on behalf of all consumers. I mean, quite frankly, you know, there's a great deal of traffic that goes over our emails that none of us give a damn about. And, you know, it may be that some consumers make a perfectly rational choice to say, I want the fastest product I can have, and I don't care a damn about what anybody sees on here. Although you may be right, they expect a certain level of security with their transactions. But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, I look at what people do on social networking sites and on the internet in general, and they're living their life like an open book. And while they don't want to share their bank account information with anybody, you know, that's only a very small percentage of their overall activity on email or social networking or anything else. And if these new requirements, these new defaults, impose a different cost, which is a cost in terms of slowing down the speed of access or just creating a new hassle for some users, that may be a trade-off that they're not willing to accept.
So one of the big problems right now is we don't have any data, and Google hasn't been really very forthcoming with this. I've repeatedly asked Google to tell me, you know, what the latency is for an average user using Gmail, because I can't actually detect any difference from my own session. I've also asked Google to provide information on the number, either number or percentage of users who've actually checked that option to enable SSL, and they're not been too keen to disclose that. You know, I understand that there are going to be, you know, some small subset of users who are going to want the fastest possible service. And I think, you know, Google's argument that choice is king here is, you know, that's fine. So let's give users the ability to opt out of encryption. And then the people who really, really care about speed, you know, can have it. You know, but with regard to your point that, well, everything we send over the clear, you know, everything we send is in the clear anyway, and people are using social networks and blah, blah, blah. You know, if that's the case, why do we even have a password on our email accounts, right? Why do these services even offer us the illusion of security when in fact they're offering nothing? And then more importantly, why does their marketing material nonstop proclaim the privacy and security promises that these companies are offering, right? So on the front page of Google Docs, it tells you that their service is secure and that you can can store your files with them without any worries. On other places, it says that many users store sensitive files on Google Docs without having to worry about, you know, the files making their way elsewhere on the internet, right? So the company is making statements about the safety of its products that the reality doesn't match. And I think, you know, that was the main criticism addressed in this letter.
Let me throw out one other angle before I ask Baron to jump back in with any other follow-up questions, which is that, let me just, in a tongue-in-cheek way, just say, you are playing right into Google's hands, my friend, in that you are basically creating a situation where you are likely to get your way with Google, and they will be able to absorb whatever cost it is that Baron has described, either monetary or otherwise. And you are essentially creating a situation where the smaller carriers or smaller operators, smaller email vendors are going to have a harder time absorbing this sort of a requirement as a default, and therefore you are essentially encouraging the greater consolidation of this industry. What say you to this?
I mean, so Google is not the market leader in email, right? They're clearly the market leader when it comes to policymakers and the tech side, but you know, Yahoo, I think, it has more than 50% of the webmail market. So, you know, it's debatable whether Yahoo can afford to pay for SSL right now, given that they're letting off people left and right. I think Microsoft can probably pay for it without batting an eyelid. And the fact is that the smaller companies can afford it too because they have less people to support, right? So SSL is just, it's one of those costs that just scales with the number of users. You know, there are small mom and pop, you know, online vendors and online shopping sites that have supported SSL for 10, 12 years. I don't see why Google or why others small vendors can't do that in this space. Now, there is another thing I wanted to address, which is this claim by Google that so what they're going to do is they're going to do a pilot with small subset of users and see how that works out in terms of speed. One of the things that Google has been sort of voicing slowly in the past few weeks, even in conversations I had with them, was that they recognize that while there may not be latency or speed issues to limit states or people in Western Europe, there were other markets in which SSL would place too much of a burden on the user or because of the network connection. And so in those countries, they were not terribly inclined to provide encryption. Now, previously, Google had said that they wanted to provide a universal experience for everyone in the world, which is, so if people in China couldn't have encryption, then people in the States weren't going to get it either. Now, the position they seem to be settling on is that people in Western countries are going to get encryption and people everywhere else are not. And you know, I just want to put on my tinfoil hat for a second and remind you that the countries where the governments are most likely to be watching the wire, except for this one where the government is watching the wire, are places like China and Burma and Iran, and those are the countries where Google is going to make this argument that the internet is too slow to support encryption. And so, you know, when thinking of this, you should also think about the fact that what Google is going to be doing is politely declining to provide users in oppressed countries protection from the government by default.
Baron, do you want one more follow-up on this before we turn to advertising?
Well, of course, we also wear tinfoil hats, Chris, so I'm glad that you've joined the club. But I just, in general here, I want to emphasize that the trade-off that I'm really interested in is not so much the immediate trade-off between speed for the user and some extra encryption. It's in the big picture. I mean, Chris, you said that these are products that these companies sell to users. I mean, the reality is they're giving these things away. Users are using them. And what Google is getting and what Yahoo and everybody else is getting is essentially an audience, right? They're eyeballs. And at the end of the day, the ability to pay for additional costs here doesn't depend on how deep your pockets are in general, right? It's not that Microsoft can pay for this because Microsoft has lots and lots of money. It ultimately comes down to how much money can these companies make off of these mail products? And at the end of the day, if your products are supported by advertising, what matters more than anything else is what your cost per click or cost per impression is for those ads. And what's been lost in this whole debate, which we'll come to in just a minute, about online advertising, is that if you restrict data collection, you are essentially tying people into doing simple contextual advertising, which means that the ads you see will only be based on the keywords in an email for webmail solutions. And in turn, that means that the ads aren't going to be worth very much because ads that sell for a lot are ads that are related to products and services. And of course, most of our email has nothing to do with that. It has to do with stupid things that, you know, don't relate to a product or service. Now, if on the other hand, companies use behavioral targeting or more sophisticated forms of targeting in webmail, they could show you ads for product and services not based on the contents of any particular email, but based on maybe other things in your email or other things you've looked at online, and they'd be able to make a lot more money off their webmail. And small companies, as Adam was mentioning, would be able to compete and offer fairly expensive services like SSL. So we can't separate this security debate from the overall debate about trade-offs in the internet economy, and at the end of the day, how we're going to keep funding all the free content and services that we take for granted.
So, Chris, before you answer that, let me just say this is a good segue to what I wanted to talk about to wrap up anyway, which is this earlier crusade of yours involving website privacy and how you sought to create a permanent opt-out cookie to stop behavioral advertising by various advertising networks, your so-called TACO project. So as you answer Baron's last comment, go ahead and work that into your answer.
Sure. So where do I start here? You know, I want to just clarify one thing that Baron said, and I think he's mostly right, which is that, you know, without a doubt, offering SSL to your customers by default reduces your profit per customer, right? Because it reduces your fixed costs for providing that customer service. And I recognize that the companies are going to either need to recoup that cost some way, or are going to have to eat lower profits per customer. You know, Barron says that the way to do that is through highly targeted behavioral ads. You know, personally, I'm happy to pay for email service. I know that Google sells access to its apps service, which includes a version of its email service, $1 a year per user. And I don't think that's really burdensome, but I think it has the power of free market. You know, there's definitely not a problem that hasn't been solved yet in terms of the market economics. One thing that I don't think anyone can do with both in the area and also in the behavioral area, I'll get to in a second, which is that these areas of companies are consumers. And I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong when you take advantage of the fact that consumers don't know what's going on. And as a result, you either collect huge amounts of data about, or you put them at risk of identity theft because they don't know how much of their data is flowing over the wire into plain text. So now moving on to my Taco tool, which is a Firefox browser add-on that opts people out of 40 different online behavioral advertising networks. You know, I want to clarify that this is not actually a privacy-enhancing tool. I wish it were a privacy-enhancing tool, except that companies like Yahoo and Microsoft persist in their position, which is that the opt-out process, which is, you know, basically every behavioral advertising firm offers an opt-out. The position is that opt-out only gets you out of display of behavioral ads, that these companies will continue to collect highly targeted information on the users. And so flipping that switch through their opt-out site merely scales you back to old-fashioned advertising based on the content of that page, right? So, unfortunately, Taco is not a privacy-enhancing tool because these companies persist in collecting data even after the user opts out. I wish it were. So Taco now has 50,000 active users. Over the past few months, I've worked with about 5 or 6 online advertising firms to make their opt-out process a little bit better, to protect the privacy of their users a little bit more. I actually have another shame campaign coming out next week that I can't tell you about just yet on this front that I'm expecting to see a strong reaction from NAI and other folks. But the fact is that, you know, again, in this space, all of these online advertising firms offer an opt-out. They hide the opt-out. They make it difficult to use. They hide it in their privacy policy 5 pages down. You know, they have obscenely short expiration dates on the opt-out cookies themselves. They don't tell people when the cookies are going to expire. You know, in most cases, customers have never even heard of these websites in the first place, so they don't even know that they need to go to these companies' sites to opt out. And then, you know, 2 months later, the cookie magically disappears. So,
okay,
you know,
Chris,
this is a market in chaos.
Let me interrupt here and bring Barron back in so he can respond to your neo-Marxist ramblings about the inherent manipulativeness of advertising and so on. Barron.
Well, I first of all, again, want to applaud Chris because, as Chris may remember, we actually called for exactly this kind of a tool back when Google launched their Ad Preference Manager. This debate has been going on for a long time where many privacy advocates have been saying that that one of the biggest problems with these opt-out cookies that are coordinated under the network advertising initiatives, one of the self-regulatory efforts, they've been claiming that one of the biggest problems with them was that they weren't persistent, that every time users deleted cookies on their computer, as for example many users do very regularly with their antivirus software, those users were inadvertently deleting all the opt-out cookies as well. And Google came out when they launched their behavioral or interest-based advertising system. They came out with not only an ads preference manager, but also a simple version of Chris's plugin that made sure that your Google opt-out cookie was preserved. Just basically scaled that up. And you know, even before Chris did that, we called for somebody to do exactly what Chris called for has done, and we did a crude version of our own just to demonstrate that this could be done feasibly. But I'm really glad that Chris did it because what it really demonstrated was that this was a fairly simple solution to implement, at least as far as it goes. And it really, to my mind, kind of put out the hypocrisy of some of our friends on the privacy advocacy side of things, who could have created this tool many years ago and didn't bother to do so because, who knows, maybe it undermined their argument for regulation or whatever. So I applaud Chris, because what I more than anything else care about here is empowering users. But I want to take this just one step farther and suggest that this whole framework that we have today about opt-in, opt-out, is in some sense really broken. I want to make the bold claim first, and then I'll tell you what I mean about the current system. But briefly, at the end of the day, my vision of the ideal circumstance here is not that every user spends lots of time thinking about what they want to do online, because most people don't want to do that, and I think that's a rational decision. That's what I would consider rational ignorance. But I do want to remedy the kind of ignorance that Chris is talking about, which has to do with the lack of really meaningful disclosures. And so what I think that ultimately would look like is a system where websites and ad networks use machine-readable code, such as, for example, you can do with P3P, to essentially label their content, whether that's their ads or the web content that you visit sites for, with their privacy policies. And in turn, that would allow users, without having to give any real thought to it, without having to read privacy policies, to have a simple tool in their browser or in a plugin that simply applies their privacy preferences. And most users might simply say that they don't want to be bothered with it, and they just want to follow the decisions that are made by somebody else. So that's a way of users being able to choose their own surrogates, right? Instead of having one surrogate, like Chris, decide for everybody what the rule is going to be about online advertising. So I think if you had that sort of a system, you could have real trade-offs, where instead of having Congressman Boucher decide that everything has to be opt-in and therefore wiping out a huge source of revenue, especially for publishers of non-commercial content who currently don't get a lot of revenue for their content on the web, instead of having that, you could have every individual person making trade-offs. And the trade-off would be they could turn their privacy setting all the way up, but if they do that, they maybe aren't going to get some content, or they might have to make a micropayment for it, or they might have to see more annoying advertising, or something like that. But that's the world in which I want to live. And the current system, which is basically a one-size-fits-all, or you opt out, is a system in which all we're going to end up doing is arguing about, you know, how easy is the opt out? Should we make it simpler through the tools that Chris is describing, or should we simply go to sort of opt-in, mandatory, restrictive default that people on the Hill seem to be thinking about? And I think that's a limited, that paradigm is very limited in its usefulness. But even under that system, I do think it's important not to downplay the control that users currently have over the collection of data for targeted advertising. And if you don't like of these things, you can just opt out right now with your cookie management tools in your browser.
Let's get Chris back in for a comment on that.
So, I mean, normally I agree with Baron, but in this area he's completely out of left field.
Actually.
Right, whatever field you're in, you're clearly insane on this one. So the fact is that users don't have the ability to opt out. So users can delete their cookies. Actually, so I was at this hearing at the House yesterday, and I think it was Representative Barton from Texas who told the audience that he actually goes through his browser every 2 days and deletes all his cookies, which got a nice chuckle from the audience. And in contrast to that, it was Representative Boucher who actually said that he's a kind of argument purchased several things as a result of those. I think it's interesting to see the Dems and the Republicans flipping on this privacy issue. But, you know, I don't think most people have any idea how the opt-out process works. I don't think most people even realize what cookies are. I don't think that most people have explored the cookies settings in their browser. I think maybe it's a little bit easier now in Firefox now that you can clear private data. But I don't think it's going to be the motivation to stop behavioral advertising that causes people to clear that stuff. I think it's probably going to be the desire to erase any information relating to porn browsing that's probably going to lead to people making use of those options. You know, I think it's false to to claim that users have all the available tools to them. You know, okay, so I have 50,000 users, but what, that's in a market of 400, 500 million internet users. You know, that is a drop in the bucket. You know, there are not easy to use tools that are built into the browser, and we need to have them. Before you jump in again, if Google wants to claim that it is providing effective privacy solutions like these opt-outs, the best thing it can do is build them into its Chrome browser to put its money where its mouth is. So, I mean, I know their browser blocks third-party cookies by default right now, which is something that Safari also does, which does minimize the effect of behavioral advertising based on web cookies. However, one of the things that's plainly clear at this point is that online marketers are using more than just cookies. They're using Flash cookies and Silverlight and Adobe Air and these other sort of persistent storage technologies, and Google Chrome isn't doing anything to protect users from those. So if Google wants to take the leadership on this and say that they're actually providing comprehensive, useful opt-out technologies to their customers, you know, the best place to do it is via their browser.
Well, Chris, let me just be really straightforward with you here and point out that I understand where you're coming from with your concerns and appreciate the fact that there are many people who are sensitive about their privacy online. But there's another side to this story that I really want to get your take on, because aren't you at all concerned, or doesn't it keep you up at night, that if you got your way and the entire internet economy was flipped on its head and moved to an opt-in regime, that economy as we know it, the economy of free and open internet services and culture, would ultimately, you know, there is no free lunch. There's going to have to be some way to pay for all of this. And, I mean, the concern that Barron and I articulate in our work is quite simple. We say that, you know, the internet is built on information. And those information flows are essential to the way that we have created this amazingly open resource, abundant resource, that is simply unprecedented in the history of communications or media. Now, that didn't happen by accident. It happened precisely because of the free flow of information, including the flow of information and collection thereof for commercial purposes. This, to me and to Barron, I think we say this is a great success story, and we don't want to stifle that development. But you, my friend, and the movement that you're a part of would essentially turn that on its head and force us all to come up with a different type of model to support all of that. And I know you're going to say, well, some broken business model isn't my problem, but you are the one breaking the business models in this case by changing the entire way that the internet works. Doesn't that keep you up at night?
Maybe out of excitement, but not out of... the fact is that, you know, behavioral advertising has not been a fundamental core part of the internet for the last 20 years, right? It is a recent addition to the advertising landscape. In addition, you know, to that, we've had advertising-supported content for generations, and it's only in the last 10, 20 years that advertisers have been able to figure anything out at all about their customers, right? Before now, they had to resort to Nielsen families and telephone polls just to find out who was even watching their show. So the fact is that, you know, one of the things that the internet has brought has been the ability for marketers to collect, you know, obscene amounts of data about and their end users and their viewers. And I think, you know, the success of media up until this point shows that it is possible to provide useful content to consumers, yet show them advertising without actually having to collect their private data.
But Chris,
let me just say this last thing, and then you can berate me, which is that, you know, maybe there's a silver lining in this, right? So if we cripple the behavioral advertising industry, maybe the newspapers will come back to life. Who knows?
Oh, boy.
Chris, I have to respond here. But listen, so the first thing we have to understand is that although we've been talking about behavioral targeting, this isn't just about behavioral targeting. This is about restricting data collection generally, and behavioral targeting is one use of data collection, but even non-behaviorally targeted advertising still relies to a considerable degree on data collection, and it does so for purposes of, for example, auditing ads to make sure you can control fraud, which is extremely important, being able to sequence ads to show them in a certain order, being able to cap the frequency with which any user sees ads. I could go on and list these things, but the point is simply that even if you take behavioral targeting out of the mix, what we're ultimately talking about is data collection, and that data basically, if you take it away, you lower the value of advertising. But you don't just lower it in the aggregate, right? It's not just like there's this big honeypot and we're talking about how big it should be and then we're going to just spread it around to fund all the free content and services we want. The central economic reality of the internet is unbundling. And what I mean by that is that you no longer have these big bundled products that you had in the days of old. So the newspaper of many years ago was a single product that had money going in, and then that money was spent on things that weren't tied to what the money was going in for. The classifieds in the back of the newspaper ended up supporting the Foreign Bureau in Beirut. And the problem, and this is the central difficulty to overcome on the internet, is that the internet is essentially unbundling content. It is making it possible to get everything a la carte. And what that means is that more and more, each piece of content or each service has to pay for itself. Because if it doesn't, nothing's going to be there to cross-subsidize it. No one's going to want to do that. So it comes down to something as simple as this. If you want to run a website that is news about East Asian politics, the value of of your content is essentially tied to the keywords in that advertising, if all you have is contextual advertising. Now, if your news story is about North Korea, you know, full contextual advertising is going to show you what? Honeymoons for the DMZ? So the problem is that those publishers, publishers of non-commercial content or content that has very little product and service connection, are going to get peanuts for their content. And that content is simply not going to be funded. Now, if on the other hand, those people can essentially sell the audience, that is, you know, basically they can make money simply because people come and look at their content, and they can sell them advertising that maybe is for digital cameras or whatever they think they might be interested in, that content actually could be supported and sustained. But it comes down to having to make your content relevant to support this unbundled services.
Chris, last word.
Right. So I'm not going to geek out and drop into the technobabble here, but I do want to push back on one thing that Baron said, because I've heard this fairly bogus argument put forth by the NAI, and I heard it yesterday from the people at Yahoo in front of them. And that is this argument that those companies need to collect data on consumers to make sure that consumers don't see the same ad five times, or to make sure that, you know, if Nike buys a series of three ads, that people actually see the first ad, then the second ad, and the third ad in order. And the idea that that company needs to collect data on their own servers to do that is completely bogus. It's so they can place a cookie in the user's browser, a non-identifiable cookie of a fairly little length, say, you know, the length of the advertising campaign, that merely has a counter. So it would list the ad campaign number, and then it would increment, you know, once, twice, three times, and after that it would show, you know, ad campaign finished. Or, you know, they could have a campaign ad number and then, you know, a different counter to show which ad has been shown so far, right? There are ways of making sure that ads are not shown too many times, or that they're shown in order in a way that the data is stored on the user's browser without the service provider mining huge amounts of data on their own computer. That gives the power to the user to delete the data if they wish to. And it definitely negates the need to collect huge swaths of data. Now, the click fraud issue is definitely a problem, something that Google and Yahoo have been subject to class action lawsuits because of. However, I would like to stress here that click fraud only relates to clicks. If you do not click on an ad, they have no business collecting data on your browsing session. However, those companies do not want to be in a position where people who click on their ads have less privacy than the people who don't. So they instead design a system where everyone has equally low privacy so as to not disincentivize people from clicking on ads. But this argument made by Baron and by Ann Toth at Yahoo yesterday is completely bogus. You do not need to collect huge amounts of data in order to make sure that ads are only shown three times.
Well, Chris, I know both Baron and I would probably push back pretty strenuously against that argument, but we're running out of time for today's show. We'd definitely like to have you back to discuss that. and to have you give us some sort of a concrete example of how there's any sort of serious harm to consumers from any of this information collection, something that Baron and I really can't find much evidence of. But again, do not answer that because we're out of time and we'll have you back. But before we close out, I want to thank you for joining me, and I want to ask you to tell our audience where they can find out more information about you, where you blog, and all that jazz.
So my website is called dubfire.net. That's D-U-B-F-I-R-E.net. Most of my papers are there. My blog is available there, and my email address can be found there too.
And your blog is called Slight Paranoia, which people can Google and find if you don't mind them Googling for it. And and we will link to it in the podcast write-up for this show. Chris Segoyan, thank you so much for joining us here today on Tech Policy Weekly.
Thank you very much, guys.
And that's going to do it for this week's show. I hope you liked it, and please leave a comment on the page if you are interested in doing so, and make sure to write a review of our show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next time, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.